At least around me. And when I got home last night, he started that again. That needed no amplification. It was a subject that the two friends had discussed completely, and upon which they agreed. Susan, summarizing the problem from Nancy's viewpoint, had once said, "You love Bobby now, and you need him. But deep down, even Bobby knows there isn't any future in it. Later on, when we go off to Manhattan, everything will seem a new world." Kansas State University is in Manhattan, and the two girls plan to enroll there as art students and to room together. "Everything will change, whether you want it to or not. But you can't change it now, living here in Holcomb, seeing Bobby every day, sitting in the same classes. And there's no reason to, because you and Bobby are a very happy thing. And it will be something happy to think back about, if you're left alone. Can't you make your father understand that?" No, she could not. Because, as she explained it to Susan, "Whenever I start to say something, he looks at me as though I must not love him, or as though I loved him less. And suddenly I'm tongue-tied. I just want to be his daughter and do as he wishes." To this, Susan had no reply. It embodied emotions, a relationship beyond her experience. She lived alone with her mother, who taught music at the Holcomb School, and she did not remember her own father very clearly. For years ago, in their native California, Mr. Kidwell had one day left home and not come back. "And anyway," Nancy continued now, "I'm not sure it's me that's making him grouchy. Something else. He's really worried about something. Your mother?" No other friend of Nancy's would have presumed to make such a suggestion. Susan, however, was privileged. When she had first appeared in Holcomb, a melancholy, imaginative child, willowy and wan and sensitive, then 8, a year younger than Nancy, the Clutters had so ardently adopted her that the fatherless little girl from California soon came to seem a member of the family. For 7 years, the two friends had been inseparable, each, by virtue of the rarity of similar and equal sensibilities, irreplaceable to the other. But then, this past September, Susan had transferred from the local school to the vaster, supposedly superior one in Garden City. It was the usual procedure for Holcomb students who intended going on to college, but Mr. Clutter, a die-hard community booster, considered such defections an affront to community spirit. The Holcomb School was good enough for his children, and there they would remain. Thus, the girls were no longer always together, and Nancy deeply felt the daytime absence of her friend, the one person with whom she need be neither brave nor reticent. "Well, but we're all so happy about Mother. You heard the wonderful news." Then Nancy said, "Listen," and hesitated, as if summoning nerve to make an outrageous remark. "Why do I keep smelling smoke? Honestly, I think I'm losing my mind. I get into the car, I walk into a room, and it's as though somebody had just been there smoking a cigarette. It isn't Mother. It can't be Kenyon. Kenyon wouldn't dare." Nor, very likely, would any visitor to the Clutter home, which was pointedly devoid of ashtrays. Slowly, Susan grasped the implication, but it was ludicrous. Regardless of what his private anxieties might be, she could not believe that Mr. Clutter was finding secret solace in tobacco. Before she could ask if this was really what Nancy meant, Nancy cut her off. "Sorry, Susie. I've got to go. Mrs. Katz is here." Dick was driving a black 1949 Chevrolet sedan. As Perry got in, he checked the back seat to see if his guitar was safely there. The previous night, after playing for a party of Dick's friends, he had forgotten and left it in the car. It was an old Gibson guitar, sandpapered and waxed to a honey-yellow finish. Another sort of instrument lay beside it, a 12-gauge pump-action shotgun. Brand new, blue-barreled, and with a sportsman's scene of pheasants in flight etched along the stock. A flashlight, a fishing knife, a pair of leather gloves, and a hunting vest fully packed with shells contributed further atmosphere to this curious still life. "You wearing that?" Perry asked, indicating the vest. Dick rapped his knuckles against the windshield. "Knock, knock. Excuse me, sir. We've been out hunting and lost our way. If we could use the phone?"
"Sí, señor. Yo comprendo."
"A cinch," said Dick. "I promise you, honey, we'll blast hair all over them walls."
"Those walls," said Perry.
A dictionary buff, a devotee of obscure words, he had been intent on improving his companion's grammar and expanding his vocabulary ever since they had celled together at Kansas State Penitentiary. Far from resenting these lessons, the pupil, to please his tutor, once composed a sheaf of poems, and though the verses were very obscene, Perry, who thought them nevertheless hilarious, had had the manuscript leather-bound in a prison shop and its title, Dirty Jokes, stamped in gold. Dick was wearing a blue jumper suit. Lettering stitched across the back of it advertised Bob Sands Body Shop. He and Perry drove along the main street of Olathe until they arrived at the Bob Sands establishment, an auto repair garage where Dick had been employed since his release from the penitentiary in mid-August. A capable mechanic, he earned $60 a week. He deserved no salary for the work he planned to do this morning, but Mr. Sands, who left him in charge on Saturdays, would never know he had paid his hireling to overhaul his own car. With Perry assisting him, he went to work. They changed the oil, adjusted the clutch, recharged the battery, replaced a throw-out bearing, and put new tires on the rear wheels. All necessary undertakings, for between today and tomorrow, the aged Chevrolet was expected to perform punishing feats. "Because the old man was around," said Dick, answering Perry, who wanted to know why he had been late in meeting him at the Little Jewel. "I didn't want him to see me taking the gun out of the house." "Christ, then he would have known I wasn't telling the truth."
"Known."
"But what did you say?" "Finally."
"Like we said. I said we'd be gone overnight. Said we was going to visit your sister in Fort Scott, on account of she was holding money for you. $1,500.
Perry had a sister, and had once had two, but the surviving one did not live in Fort Scott, a Kansas town 85 miles from Olathe. In fact, he was uncertain of her present address.
"And was he sore?"
"Why should he be sore?"
"Because he hates me," said Perry,
whose voice was both gentle and prim. A voice that, though soft, manufactured each word exactly, ejected it like a smoke ring issuing from a parson's mouth.
"So does your mother."
I could see the ineffable way they looked at me. Dick shrugged. "Nothing to do with you. As such. It's just they don't like me seeing anybody from the walls. Twice married, twice divorced, now 28 and the father of 3 boys, Dick had received his parole on the condition that he reside with his parents. The family, which included a younger brother, lived on a small farm near Olathe. "Anybody wearing the fraternity pin," he added, and touched a blue dot tattooed under his left eye. An insignia, a visible password, by which certain former prison inmates could identify him.
"I understand," said Perry. "I sympathize with that. They're good people. She's a real sweet person, your mother."
Dick nodded. He thought so, too. At noon, they put down their tools, and Dick, racing the engine, listening to the consistent hum, was satisfied that a thorough job had been done. Nancy and her protege, Jolene Katz, were also satisfied with their morning's work. Indeed, the latter, a thin 13-year-old, was agog with pride. For the longest while, she stared at the blue ribbon winner, the oven-hot cherries simmering under the crisp lattice crust, and then she was overcome, and hugging Nancy, asked,
"Honest, did I really make it myself?"
Nancy laughed, returned the embrace, and assured her that she had, with a little help. Jolene urged that they sample the pie at once. No nonsense about leaving it to cool.
"Please, let's both have a piece." And you too,
she said to Mrs. Clutter, who had come into the kitchen. Mrs. Clutter smiled, attempted to, her head ached, and said thank you, but she hadn't the appetite. As for Nancy, she hadn't the time. Roxy Lee Smith and Roxy Lee's trumpet solo awaited her, and afterward those errands for her mother, one of which concerned a bridal shower that some Garden City girls were organizing for Beverly, and another the Thanksgiving gala.
You go, dear. I'll keep Jolene company until her mother comes for her, Mrs. Clutter said, and then, addressing the child with unconquerable timidity, added, If Jolene doesn't mind keeping me company.
As a girl, she had won an elocution prize. Maturity, it seemed, had reduced her voice to a single tone, that of apology, and her personality to a series of gestures blurred by the fear that she might give offense, in some way displease.
I hope you understand, she continued after her daughter's departure. I hope you won't think Nancy rude.
Goodness, no. I just love her to death.
Well, everybody does. There isn't anybody like Nancy.
Do you know what Mrs. Stringer says? Said Jolene, naming her home economics teacher.
One day she told the class, Nancy Clutter is always in a hurry, but she always has time. And that's one definition of a lady.
Yes, replied Mrs. Clutter. All my children are very efficient.
They don't need me.
Jolene had never before been alone with Nancy's strange mother, but despite discussions she had heard, she felt much at ease, for Mrs. Clutter, though unrelaxed herself, had a relaxing quality, as is generally true of defenseless persons who present no threat. Even in Jolene, a very childlike child, Mrs. Clutter's heart-shaped missionary's face, her look of helpless, homespun ethereality, aroused protective compassion.
But to think that she was Nancy's mother.
An aunt? That seemed possible. A visiting spinster aunt. Slightly odd, but nice.
No, they don't need me, she repeated, pouring herself a cup of coffee.
Though all the other members of the family observed her husband's boycott of this beverage, she drank two cups every morning and often as not ate nothing else the rest of the day. She weighed 98 pounds. Rings, a wedding band, and one set with a diamond modest to the point of meekness, wobbled on one of her bony hands. Jolene cut a piece of pie.
Boy, she said, wolfing it down, I'm going to make one of these every day, 7 days a week.
Well, you have all those little brothers, and boys can eat a lot of pie.
Mr. Clutter and Kenyon, I know they never get tired of them.
But the cook does. Nancy just turns up her nose. It'll be the same with you.
No, no. Why do I say that?
Mrs. Clutter, who wore rimless glasses, removed them and pressed her eyes.
Forgive me, dear. I'm sure you'll never know what it is to be tired. I'm sure you'll always be happy.
Jolene was silent. The note of panic in Mrs. Clutter's voice had caused her to have a shift of feeling. Jolene was confused and wished that her mother, who had promised to call back for her at 11, would come. Presently, more calmly, Mrs. Clutter asked,
Do you like miniature things? Tiny things?
And invited Jolene into the dining room to inspect the shelves of a whatnot on which were arranged assorted Lilliputian gewgaws. Scissors, thimbles, crystal flower baskets, toy figurines, forks and knives.
I've had some of these since I was a child.
Daddy and Mama, all of us, spent part of most years in California,
by the ocean.
And there was a shop that sold such precious little things.
These cups.
A set of dollhouse teacups, anchored to a diminutive tray, trembled in the palm of her hand.
Daddy gave them to me. I had a lovely childhood.
The only daughter of a prosperous wheat grower named Fox, the adored sister of three older brothers, she had not been spoiled but spared, led to suppose that life was a sequence of agreeable events. Kansas autumns, California summers, a round of teacup gifts. When she was 18, inflamed by a biography of Florence Nightingale, she enrolled as a student nurse at St. Rose's Hospital in Great Bend, Kansas. She was not meant to be a nurse, and after 2 years, she confessed it. A hospital's realities, scenes, odors, sickened her. Yet to this day she regretted not having completed the course and received her diploma, just to prove, as she had told a friend, that I once succeeded at something. Instead, she had met and married Herb, a college classmate of her oldest brother Glenn. Actually, since the two families lived within 20 miles of each other, she had long known him by sight, but the Clutters, plain farm people, were not on visiting terms with the well-to-do and cultivated Foxes. However, Herb was handsome. He was pious. He was strong-willed. He wanted her, and she was in love. "Mr. Clutter travels a great deal," she said to Jolene. "Oh, he's always headed somewhere. Washington and Chicago and Oklahoma and Kansas City. Sometimes it seems like he's never home. But wherever he goes, he remembers how I dote on tiny things." She unfolded a little paper fan. "He brought me this from San Francisco. It only cost a penny. But isn't it pretty?" The second year of the marriage, Eviana was born, and 3 years later, Beverly. After each confinement, the young mother had experienced an inexplicable despondency. Seizures of grief that sent her wandering from room to room in a hand-wringing daze. Between the births of Beverly and Nancy, 3 more years elapsed, and these were the years of the Sunday picnics and of summer excursions to Colorado, the years when she really ran her own home and was the happy center of it. But with Nancy, and then with Kenyon, the pattern of postnatal depression repeated itself, and following the birth of her son, the mood of misery that descended never altogether lifted. It lingered like a cloud that might rain or might not. She knew good days, and occasionally they accumulated into weeks, months. But even on the best of the good days, those days when she was otherwise her old self, the affectionate and charming Bonnie her friends cherished, she could not summon the social vitality her husband's pyramiding activities required. He was a joiner, a born leader. She was not, and stopped attempting to be. And so, along paths bordered by tender regard, by total fidelity, they began to go their semi-separate ways. His a public route, a march of satisfying conquests, and hers a private one that eventually wound through hospital corridors. But she was not without hope. Trust in God sustained her, and from time to time secular sources supplemented her faith in his forthcoming mercy. She read of a miracle medicine, heard of a new therapy, or, as most recently, decided to believe that a pinched nerve was to blame. "Little things really belong to you," she said, folding the fan. "They don't have to be left behind. You can carry them in a shoebox."
"Carry them where to?"
"Why, wherever you go.
You might be gone for a long time."
Some years earlier, Mrs. Clutter had traveled to Wichita for 2 weeks of treatment and remained 2 months. On the advice of a doctor who had thought the experience would aid her to regain a sense of adequacy and usefulness, she had taken an apartment, then found a job, as a file clerk at the YWCA. Her husband, entirely sympathetic, had encouraged the adventure, but she had liked it too well, so much that it seemed to her unchristian, and the sense of guilt she in consequence developed ultimately outweighed the experiment's therapeutic value.
"Or you might never go home. And it's important always to have with you something of your own. It's really yours."
The doorbell rang. It was Jolene's mother. Mrs. Clutter said, "Goodbye, dear," and pressed into Jolene's hand the paper fan.
"It's only a penny thing, but it's pretty.
Afterward, Mrs. Clutter was alone in the house. Kenyon and Mr. Clutter had gone to Garden City. Gerald Van Vliet had left for the day, and the housekeeper, the blessed Mrs. Helm to whom she could confide anything, did not come to work on Saturdays. She might as well go back to bed. The bed she so rarely abandoned that poor Mrs. Helm had to battle for the chance to change its linen twice a week. There were four bedrooms on the second floor, and hers was the last at the end of a spacious hall, which was bare except for a baby crib that had been bought for the visits of her grandson. If cots were brought in and the hall was used as a dormitory, Mrs. Clutter estimated, the house could accommodate 20 guests during the Thanksgiving holidays. The others would have to lodge at motels or with neighbors. Among the Clutter kinfolk, the Thanksgiving get-together was an annual turnabout to do, and this year Herb was the appointed host, so it had to be done. But coinciding as it did with the preparations for Beverly's wedding, Mrs. Clutter despaired of surviving either project. Both involved the necessity of making decisions, a process she had always disliked and had learned to dread, for when her husband was off on one of his business journeys, she was continually expected, in his absence, to supply snap judgments concerning the affairs of the farm, and it was unendurable, a torment. What if she made a mistake? What if Herb should be displeased? Better to lock the bedroom door and pretend not to hear, or say, as she sometimes did, "I can't. I don't know. Please." The room she so seldom left was austere. Had the bed been made, a visitor might have thought it permanently unoccupied. An oak bed, a walnut bureau, a bedside table. Nothing else except lamps, one curtained window, and a picture of Jesus walking on the water. It was as though by keeping this room impersonal, by not importing her intimate belongings but leaving them mingled with those of her husband, she lessened the offense of not sharing his quarters. The only used drawer in the bureau contained a jar of Vicks VapoRub, Kleenex, an electric heating pad, a number of white nightgowns, and white cotton socks. She always wore a pair of these socks to bed, for she was always cold. And for the same reason, she habitually kept her windows closed. Summer before last, on a sweltering August Sunday, when she was secluded here, a difficult incident had taken place. There were guests that day, a party of friends who had been invited to the farm to pick mulberries, and among them was Wilma Kidwell, Susan's mother. Like most of the people who were often entertained by the Clutters, Mrs. Kidwell accepted the absence of the hostess without comment, and assumed, as was the custom, that she was either indisposed or away in Wichita. In any event, when the hour came to go to the fruit orchard, Mrs. Kidwell declined. A city-bred woman, easily fatigued, she wished to remain indoors. Later, while she was awaiting the return of the mulberry pickers, she heard the sound of weeping. Heartbroken. Heartbreaking. "Bonnie?" she called and ran up the stairs, ran down the hall to Bonnie's room. When she opened it, the heat gathered inside the room was like a sudden, awful hand over her mouth. She hurried to open a window. "Don't!" Bonnie cried. "I'm not hot. I'm cold. I'm freezing. Lord, Lord, Lord!" She flailed her arms. "Please, Lord, don't let anybody see me this way." Mrs. Kidwell sat down on the bed. She wanted to hold Bonnie in her arms, and eventually Bonnie let herself be held. "Wilma," she said. "I've been listening to you, Wilma. All of you. Laughing. Having a good time. I'm missing out on everything. The best years, the children, everything. A little while and even Kenyon will be grown up. A man. And how will he remember me? As a kind of ghost, Wilma." Now, on this final day of her life, Mrs. Clutter hung in the closet the calico house dress she had been wearing and put on one of her trailing nightgowns and a fresh set of white socks. Then, Before retiring, she exchanged her ordinary glasses for a pair of reading spectacles. Though she subscribed to several periodicals, the Ladies' Home Journal, McCall's, Reader's Digest, and, together, Mid-Month Magazine for Methodist Families, none of these rested on the bedside table. Only a Bible. A bookmark lay between its pages, a stiff piece of watered silk upon which an admonition had been embroidered. Take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. The two young men had little in common, but they did not realize it, for they shared a number of surface traits. Both, for example, were fastidious, very attentive to hygiene and the condition of their fingernails. After their grease monkey morning, they spent the better part of an hour sprucing up in the lavatory of the garage. Dick stripped to his briefs was not quite the same as Dick fully clothed. In the latter state, he seemed a flimsy, dingy blonde youth of medium height, fleshless and perhaps sunken-chested. Disrobing revealed that he was nothing of the sort, but rather an athlete constructed on a welterweight scale. The tattooed face of a cat, blue and grinning, covered his right hand. On one shoulder a blue rose blossomed. More markings, self-designed and self-executed, ornamented his arms and torso. The head of a dragon with a human skull between its open jaws. Bosomy nudes. A gremlin brandishing a pitchfork. The word peace accompanied by a cross radiating, in the form of crude strokes, rays of holy light. And two sentimental concoctions. One a bouquet of flowers dedicated to Mother, Dad. The other a heart that celebrated the romance of Dick and Carol, the girl whom he had married when he was 19 and from whom he had separated 6 years later in order to do the right thing by another young lady, the mother of his youngest child. "I have three boys who I will definitely take care of," he had written in applying for parole. "My wife is remarried. I have been married twice, only I don't want anything to do with my second wife." But neither Dick's physique nor the inky gallery adorning it made as remarkable an impression as his face, which seemed composed of mismatching parts. It was as though his head had been halved like an apple, then put together a fraction off-center. Something of the kind had happened. The imperfectly aligned features were the outcome of a car collision in 1950, an accident that left his long-jawed and narrow face tilted, the left side rather lower than the right, with the results that the lips were slightly aslant, the nose askew, and his eyes not only situated at uneven levels but of uneven size, the left eye being truly serpentine, with a venomous, sickly blue squint that, although it was involuntarily acquired, seemed nevertheless to warn of bitter sediment at the bottom of his nature. But Perry had told him, "The eye doesn't matter, because you have a wonderful smile. One of those smiles that really work." It was true that the tightening action of a smile contracted his face into its correct proportions and made it possible to discern a less unnerving personality. An American-style good kid with an outgrown crew cut, sane enough but not too bright. Actually, he was very intelligent. An IQ test taken in prison gave him a rating of 130. The average subject, in prison or out, scores between 90 and 110. Perry, too, had been maimed, and his injuries, received in a motorcycle wreck, were severer than Dick's. He had spent half a year in a State of Washington hospital and another 6 months on crutches, and though the accident had occurred in 1952, his chunky, dwarfish legs, broken in five places and pitifully scarred, still pained him so severely that he had become an aspirin addict. While he had fewer tattoos than his companion, they were more elaborate. Not the self-inflicted work of an amateur, but epics of the art contrived by Honolulu and Yokohama masters. Cookie, the name of a nurse who had been friendly to him when he was hospitalized, was tattooed on his right biceps. Blue-furred, orange-eyed, red-fanged, a tiger snarled upon his left biceps. A spitting snake, coiled around a dagger, slithered down his arm. and elsewhere skulls gleamed, a tombstone loomed, a chrysanthemum flourished.
"Okay, beauty, put away the comb," said Dick, dressed now and ready to go. Having discarded his work uniform, he wore gray khakis, a matching shirt, and, like Perry, ankle-high black boots. Perry, who could never find trousers to fit his truncated lower half, wore blue jeans rolled up at the bottom and a leather windbreaker. Scrubbed, combed, as tidy as two dudes setting off on a double date, they went out to the car. The distance between Olathe, a suburb of Kansas City, and Holcomb, which might be called the suburb of Garden City, is approximately 400 miles. A town of 11,000, Garden City began assembling its founders soon after the Civil War. An itinerant buffalo hunter, Mr. C.J. Buffalo Jones, had much to do with its subsequent expansion from a collection of huts and hitching posts into an opulent ranching center with razzle-dazzle saloons, an opera house, and the plushiest hotel anywhere between Kansas City and Denver. In brief, a specimen of frontier fanciness that rivaled a more famous settlement 50 miles east of it, Dodge City. Along with Buffalo Jones, who lost his money and then his mind, the last years of his life were spent haranguing street groups against the wanton extermination of the beasts he himself had so profitably slaughtered, the glamours of the past are today entombed. Some souvenirs exist. A moderately colorful row of commercial buildings is known as the Buffalo Block, and the once splendid Windsor Hotel, with its still splendid high-ceilinged saloon and its atmosphere of spittoons and potted palms, endures amid the variety stores and supermarkets as a Main Street landmark, one comparatively unpatronized. For the Windsor's dark, huge chambers and echoing hallways, evocative as they are, cannot compete with the air-conditioned amenities offered at the trim little Hotel Warren, or with the Wheatlands Motel's individual television sets and heated swimming pool. Anyone who has made the coast-to-coast journey across America, whether by train or by car, has probably passed through Garden City, but it is reasonable to assume that few travelers remember the event. It seems just another fair-sized town in the middle, almost the exact middle, of the continental United States. Not that the inhabitants would tolerate such an opinion, perhaps rightly. Though they may overstate the case, look all over the world and you won't find friendlier people or fresher air or sweeter drinking water. And I could go to Denver at triple the salary, but I've got 5 kids and I figure there's no better place to raise kids than right here. Swell schools with every kind of sport. We even have a junior college. And I came out here to practice law. A temporary thing. I never planned to stay. But when the chance came to move, I thought, why go? What the hell for? Maybe it's not New York. But who wants New York? Good neighbors. People who care about each other. That's what counts. And everything else a decent man needs. We've got that, too. Beautiful churches. A golf course. The newcomer to Garden City, once he has adjusted to the nightly after-8 silence of Main Street, discovers much to support the defensive boastings of the citizenry. A well-run public library, a competent daily newspaper, green lawned and shady squares here and there, placid residential streets where animals and children are safe to run free, a big, rambling park complete with a small menagerie. See the polar bears, see Penny the elephant, and a swimming pool that consumes several acres. World's largest free swim pool. Such accessories, and the dust and the winds and the ever-calling train whistles, add up to a hometown that is probably remembered with nostalgia by those who have left it, and that for those who have remained, provides a sense of roots and contentment. Without exception, Garden Cityans deny that the population of the town can be socially graded. No, sir. Nothing like that here. All equal, regardless of wealth, color, or creed. Everything the way it ought to be in a democracy. That's us. But of course, class distinctions are as clearly observed and as clearly observable as in any other human hive. 100 miles west and one would be out of the Bible Belt, that gospel-haunted strip of American territory in which a man must,
if only for business reasons, take his religion with the straightest of faces. But in Finney County, one is still within the Bible Belt borders, and therefore a person's church affiliation is the most important factor influencing his class status. A combination of Baptists, Methodists, and Roman Catholics would account for 80% of the county's devout. Yet among the elite, the businessmen, bankers, lawyers, physicians, and more prominent ranchers who tenant the top drawer, Presbyterians and Episcopalians predominate. An occasional Methodist is welcomed, and once in a while a Democrat infiltrates. But on the whole, the establishment is composed of right-wing Republicans of the Presbyterian and Episcopalian faiths. As an educated man successful in his profession, as an eminent Republican and church leader, even though of the Methodist Church, Mr. Clutter was entitled to rank among the local patricians, but just as he had never joined the Garden City Country Club, he had never sought to associate with the reigning coterie. Quite the contrary, for their pleasures were not his. He had no use for card games, golf, cocktails, or buffet suppers served at 10, or indeed for any pastime that he felt did not accomplish something. Which is why, instead of being part of a golfing foursome on this shining Saturday, Mr. Clutter was acting as chairman of a meeting of the Finney County 4-H Club. 4-H stands for Head, Heart, Hands, Health, and the club motto claims, "We learn to do by doing." It is a national organization with overseas branches whose purpose is to help those living in rural areas, and the children particularly, develop practical abilities and moral character. Nancy and Kenyon had been conscientious members from the age of 6. Toward the end of the meeting, Mr. Clutter said, "Now I have something to say concerning one of our adult members." His eyes singled out a chubby Japanese woman surrounded by 4 chubby Japanese children. "You all know Mrs. Hideo Ishida. Know how the Ishidas moved here from Colorado. Started farming out to Holcomb 2 years ago. A fine family, the kind of people Holcomb's lucky to have. As anyone will tell you. Anyone who has been sick and had Mrs. Ishida walk, nobody can calculate how many miles to bring them some of the wonderful soups she makes, or the flowers she grows where you wouldn't expect a flower could grow. And last year at the county fair, you will recall how much she contributed to the success of the 4-H exhibits. So I want to suggest we honor Mrs. Ishida with an award at our achievement banquet next Tuesday." Her children tugged at her, punched her. The oldest boy shouted, "Hey, Ma, that's you." But Mrs. Ishida was bashful. She rubbed her eyes with her baby plump hands and laughed. She was the wife of a tenant farmer. The farm, an especially wind-swept and lonesome one, was halfway between Garden City and Holcomb. After 4-H conferences, Mr. Clutter usually drove the Ishidas home, and he did so today.
"Gosh, that was a jolt," said Mrs. Ishida as they rolled along Route 50 in Mr. Clutter's pickup truck. "Seems like I'm always thanking you, Herb. But thanks." She had met him on her second day in Finney County. It was the day before Halloween, and he and Kenyon had come to call, bringing a load of pumpkins and squash. All through that first hard year, gifts had arrived, of produce that the Ishidas had not yet planted, baskets of asparagus, lettuce, and Nancy often brought Babe by for the children to ride. "You know, in most ways, this is the best place we've ever lived. Hideo says the same. We sure hate to think about leaving, starting all over again."
"Leaving?" protested Mr. Clutter, and slowed the car. "Well, Herb, the farm here, the people we're working for. Hideo thinks we could do better. Maybe in Nebraska. But nothing's settled. It's just talk so far." Her hearty voice, always on the verge of laughter, made the melancholy news sound somehow cheerful, but seeing that she had saddened Mr. Clutter, she turned to other matters. "Herb, give me a man's opinion," she said. "Me and the kids. We've been saving up. We want to give Hideo something on the grand side for Christmas. What he needs is teeth. Now, if your wife was to give you 3 gold teeth, would that strike you as a wrong kind of present? I mean,
Asking a man to spend Christmas in the dentist's chair?
You beat all. Don't ever try to get away from here. We'll hogtie you, said Mr. Clutter. Yes, yes, by all means, Gold Teeth.
Was me, I'd be tickled. His reaction delighted Mrs. Ishida, for she knew he would not approve her plan unless he meant it. He was a gentleman. She had never known him to act the squire, or to take advantage or break a promise. She ventured to obtain a promise now.
Look, Herb, at the banquet. No speeches, huh? Not for me.
You're different. The way you can stand up and talk to hundreds of people.
Thousands.
And be so easy. Convince anybody about whatever.
Just nothing scares you, she said, commenting upon a generally recognized quality of Mr. Clutter's. A fearless self-assurance that set him apart, and while it created respect, also limited the affections of others a little.
I can't imagine you afraid. No matter what happened, you'd talk your way out of it.
By mid-afternoon, the black Chevrolet had reached Emporia, Kansas. A large town, almost a city, and a safe place, so the occupants of the car had decided, to do a bit of shopping. They parked on a side street, then wandered about until a suitably crowded variety store presented itself. The first purchase was a pair of rubber gloves. These were for Perry, who, unlike Dick, had neglected to bring old gloves of his own. They moved on to a counter displaying women's hosiery. After a spell of indecisive quibbling, Perry said, "I'm for it." Dick was not.
"What about my eye? They're all too light-colored to hide that."
"Miss," said Perry, attracting a salesgirl's attention, "you got any black stockings?" When she told him no, he proposed that they try another store. Black's foolproof. But Dick had made up his mind. Stockings of any shade were unnecessary. An encumbrance, a useless expense. I've already invested enough money in this operation. And after all, anyone they encountered would not live to bear witness. No witnesses, he reminded Perry for what seemed to Perry the millionth time. It rankled in him, the way Dick mouthed those two words, as though they solved every problem. He was stupid not to admit that there might be a witness they hadn't seen.
The ineffable happens. Things do take a turn, he said.
But Dick, smiling boastfully, boyishly, did not agree.
Get the bubbles out of your blood. Nothing can go wrong.
No. Because the plan was Dick's, and from first footfall to final silence, flawlessly devised. Next, they were interested in rope. Perry studied the stock, tested it. Having once served in the merchant marine, he understood rope and was clever with knots. He chose a white nylon cord, as strong as wire and not much thicker. They discussed how many yards of it they required. The question irritated Dick, for it was part of a greater quandary, and he could not, despite the alleged perfection of his overall design, be certain of the answer. Eventually he said, "Christ, how the hell should I know?"
"You damn well better."
Dick tried. "There's him, her, the kid and the girl, and maybe the other two. But it's Saturday. They might have guests. Let's count on 8, or even 12. The only sure thing is every one of them has got to go."
"Seems like a lot of it, to be so sure about."
"Ain't that what I promised you, honey? Plenty of hair on them, those walls?"
Perry shrugged.
"Then we better buy the whole roll."
It was 100 yards long, quite enough for 12. Kenyon had built the chest himself, a mahogany hope chest lined with cedar, which he intended to give Beverly as a wedding present. Now, working on it in the so-called den in the basement, he applied a last coat of varnish. The furniture of the den, a cement-floored room that ran the length of the house, consisted almost entirely of examples of his carpentry. Shelves, tables, stools, a ping-pong table, and Nancy's needlework. Chintz slip covers that rejuvenated a decrepit couch, curtains, pillows bearing legends, happy, and you don't have to be crazy to live here, but it helps. Together, Kenyon and Nancy had made a paint-splattered attempt to deprive the basement room of its un-